from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the Sacramento Saturday Club. It's one of the oldest music societies west of the Rockies. Also, an update on the plan to try and bring the Winter Olympics to Reno and Tahoe, and a program that helps homeless women back on their feet. But first, money for low-income children with expensive illnesses is being cut because of California's budget problems. The program is called California Children's Services. The state is cutting reimbursement rates to providers as part of wide-ranging budget cuts forced by California's fiscal problems. We wanted to find out what impact this will have. In a little moment, we'll talk with the leader of an advocacy group for children in this situation and a doctor who provides these services. But we'll start with a Northern California parent. Wendy Longwell lives in Anderson, that's north of Red Bluff, and her son relies on CCS, California Children's Services. Wendy Longwell, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Well, your son Derek relies on this program. Could you tell us first a little bit about his condition?
Derek has spina bifida and hydrocephalus, so he is in a wheelchair and has had 26 surgeries in his life. He's going to be 13 next month. So he had a lot of complications, and we see a lot of different doctors.
26 surgeries?
Yes.
This sounds, all told, like a very expensive condition to treat.
For Derek, it has been, yes.
And how have you been able to pay for this? Do you have you had private health insurance that covered any of this?
We did the first year of his life, and right when he was turning about a year old, the insurance company contacted us and told us that he had met his lifetime maximum and that he was no longer going to be insured. And so at that point, we got him on Medi-Cal and CCS.
So does that mean that, as far as you're aware, you just can't get private insurance for Derek any longer?
Yeah, they, you know, all the pre-existing conditions, there's a lot of rules and regulations. I mean, we have insurance for him, you know, as far as dental and stuff, because that isn't part of his condition. But it's really hard to get anybody to cover all of the things that he needs because, you know, just in equipment, you know, such as his wheelchair and his braces, you're probably looking at an average of $5,000 a year. Then his medical equipment that he uses, and, you know, it's, what is it called, that where you use it once and then throw it away.
Disposable.
Yeah, disposable. That probably costs around $500 a month, and CCS helps pay for all of that.
Sounds like if without private health insurance, you'd need to have a substantial income to cover all these costs.
Yeah, you would.
Is Derek aware of what the implications are of this for his family?
As much as any 13-year-old is.
Yeah. No.
I mean, I try to keep him up to, you know, where he knows what's going on, because he does go to the Capitol a lot with me and talk to the legislators about when they want to do budget cuts. So he goes down there about once or twice a year with me, and so I try to keep him up on it so that he can talk with the legislators and give them examples of how it affects him.
We're talking about upcoming cuts to California Children's Services. It's a California program that helps pay for the medical bills of children in lower and moderate income families and with kids who have expensive illnesses such as spina bifida, which is the case with the son of my guest, Wendy Longwell, who lives in Anderson, north of Red Bluff. With these upcoming cuts to CCS and Medi-Cal, what will this mean for you and Derek?
For Derek, it's harder to get into pediatric doctors now because of the cutbacks. I've been working on trying to get him into a new specialist, and I've been going it seems like a vicious circle, and I'm just not getting anywhere. And fortunately, with the doctors that he already has, we've been with them for 10 years, so nothing is happening there. But a lot of doctors are saying they're not going to take anybody new because they can't afford to take anybody new that's on CCS or Medi-Cal. And so far, the only one that I have been notified that's not going to take it anymore is the place that we got his wheelchair from. They actually closed down because of the cutbacks.
Mm.
So as far as staying with our doctors, our doctors haven't told us that they aren't taking him anymore. But getting into new doctors is becoming very difficult. One, they either don't want to take him, or two, you just can't find them. Most of our specialist doctors we have to drive down to Sacramento or San Francisco for.
And that's a few hours, I guess, for you.
Yeah, for Sacramento, it's 2.5 hours.
Okay. Wendy Longwell. In our studio, Erin Aber-Givens, who's Executive Director of the Children's Specialty Care Coalition. Erin, welcome.
Thank you.
How typical is the story of Wendy and Derek?
Unfortunately, it's far too typical. This is one of the reasons why our group formed, because through the 90s, we were finding that families who had children with serious, rare, and chronic health conditions, such as cancer, spina bifida, congenital heart disease, they were having to wait months and months and months to try to get into their needed medical care services with pediatric subspecialists. So our group formed to try to address that very problem, to try to make sure that children with special health care needs in California could get timely and quality medical care services. So pediatric subspecialists throughout the state work together with the sole focus of trying to improve the system of care for these kids and get them into medical care in a timely way.
Also with us, Dr. Gregory Janis, who's pediatric cardiologist and medical director of children's services at Sutter Health Sacramento Sierra Region and Sutter Medical Center Sacramento. Dr. Janis, welcome.
Thank you.
What do doctors make of all this?
This is of great concern to us because the specialist doctors that Wendy and Erin have referred to are rare commodities. In California, we have close to 2,000 or 3,000 that take care of a variety of illnesses, everything from cancer to asthma to congenital heart problems, birth defects such as I take care of. And we have an increasing population. We have a spread out population in California. And so access to care is critical. And many of these children have very complicated problems that require multiple specialists, require a team work in order to take care of them. And so with an increasing number of patients, with decreasing numbers of physician specialists, the wait time, the time to access is becoming more and more of a problem. Example, in Sacramento, the wait time for some children with newly diagnosed with diabetes can be weeks to months to see a specialist. With the cutbacks in reimbursement, we have a dual problem. Number one, we have a difficulty recruiting and retaining physicians in California. Even physicians that are trained here are leaving California to go to other states. With additional cutbacks, it disincentivizes and makes it even more difficult to recruit and have adequate numbers to take care of the growing number of patients.
I'm sure some people listening to this are going, well, you know, doctors make a lot of money. I mean, surely they can take a small cut in the reimbursement rate.
Well, the thing about the physicians that make up our groups, most of the children that they take care of are in the Medi-Cal and CCS program. So within our groups, 50 to 72% of the children they see are in these low-income programs. So the low reimbursement that the state provides is the basis and determines the level availability, the level of a number of physicians we'll have here in California ready to serve these children. So state reimbursement really sets the benchmark for the level of access for all children in California. Just to give some examples, recently one of our groups down south just lost a pediatric endocrinologist, a pediatric pulmonologist up here in Northern California. We've lost specialists to other states such as Oregon, Ohio, even Canada. So it's a very serious situation.
Yeah.
When a child with a complicated problem such as the ones we've discussed does not have adequate access to care, then we really run the risk of those children falling through the safety net that we've tried to create for them so that they get not only preventative care, but maintenance care to keep them as healthy as possible. And as a result, many of them then will end up going to emergency rooms. Many of them will be admitted to hospitals, perhaps unnecessarily, because they didn't receive the preventative care that they needed. So it is a burden to everybody, obviously to the family and patient, but also to the society that has to pay for the extra costs.
And just very briefly, how does CCS work in terms of reimbursement?
So it works similar to the Medi-Cal program or any other type of coverage where Well, CCS is a little different, actually. It sets standards for care for children with these very serious health conditions. So the physicians and hospitals that participate in the program have to meet certain standards. So if a physician who has the proper credentials and pediatric training is accepted into the program, once the child is eligible, then they get the services, and then the physician bills the state for that care.
Now, what is the cut that's going to happen?
Well, as you know, the state is encountering a very serious budget crisis this year, and they took mid-year cuts back in February. And so what has already been adopted is a 10% reduction in physician reimbursement for CCS. It's been adopted, but it does not go into effect till July 1st. So we're hoping that there's still time to stave off this cut and try to maintain these services for these children.
Dr. Janice, what would this mean for you and the people you work with, assuming these cuts take place?
I'll give you an example. Because of the area that we cover for children with special health care needs is so broad, I run a clinic in Waurika, which is close to the Oregon border, and I go up there three times a year to make access to families that have children with heart disease, many of them very complicated heart problems. If I were not to be able to go to those clinics, it would, number one, the medical care that they have access to in the area is not specialized, and this is highly specialized care. These children and families would be forced to travel long distances to receive their care. With a cut like this, it could make it very difficult to even cover cost of running such a clinic. And the families would then have to travel long distances. Many of them would be lost to care and would fall into that category that I described previously of having to rely upon emergency room care, for instance.
We're talking about upcoming cuts to California Children's Services. It's a program that helps cover the costs of the very expensive care that is required for some low and moderate income children in California. My guest on the phone, Wendy Longwell. Her 13-year-old son has spina bifida. My other guests are Erin Aber-Givens, Executive Director of the Children's Specialty Care Coalition, and Dr. Gregory Janice, who's a pediatric cardiologist at Sutter. Tell us, Erin, in fact, this is going to be a question for all of you. You all would like to stop these cuts from happening, but of course the lawmakers and the governor will say, what are we supposed to do? The state is maybe $15 billion out of whack, the budget. We've got to cut money somewhere. I'll start with you, Erin.
It's an enormous problem. I don't envy their position. But I think, you know, to put this cut in context, this since 1982, there has only been one increase in reimbursement for physician services under CCS. The reimbursement is under Medicare levels. It's very low. And as I said earlier, it really determines the availability of direct medical care services that sick children in California will have. So we think that Californians do want children to be able to get the health care they need and deserve, and that this should be a priority in these budget discussions. And we're very hopeful that at the end of the day, when the budget is adopted, that there will be a compassionate mix of solutions, including prioritizing these services for these kids.
Wendy Longwell, what would you say to a lawmaker who said, you know, we've got to cut $15 billion, something's got to go?
Well, I'm kind of like Erin. I appreciate where they're at and how they're trying to balance it, but to cut where it's the most needy is going to end up costing them more in the long run. So they need to look at, you know, how is this going to balance out? Because if I can't get to physicians and end up in the emergency room with my son, with his condition, he'd end up having to be air flown to a hospital that can take care of him. How much more is that going to cost him versus just paying the doctors enough where they will stay on?
And Gregory Janice?
I echo both Wendy and Erin's comments, and I, again, respect the difficult decisions they have to make, but it's a matter of making priorities. We're talking about taking care of the sickest and most fragile of our state citizens. And if we were to make this cut, it would compound the problem because we would have increasing number of patients and potentially decreasing number of specialists to take care of them. And, you could save now or you can pay more later. And I'm afraid that by doing this, we would have compounded the problem even more in 3 to 5 years.
We don't have the time to go into this, but I have to go back to something Wendy said at the beginning, which seems to me a more fundamental problem. And that is that Derek ran out of private insurance by the time he was 1 year old. He used up his lifetime allowance. Aaron, that seems to be a bigger problem.
It is a big problem. But if you look at the history of California, California has actually been on the leading edge of protecting families whose children have rare and catastrophic health conditions. The CCS program was created in 1927 as a result of the polio epidemic and families going bankrupt trying to protect their children who had polio. And then as medical science was able to treat more childhood conditions, the program then addressed those conditions as well. So we have a strong history in California of protecting these families, of making sure these children have health care. Certainly health care reform that was discussed earlier, we were very supportive of those efforts. We're very hopeful that, you know, once we solve this budget crisis, we can get back to work on those issues.
Well, thank you all very much. On the phone, Wendy Longwell. In our studio, Dr. Gregory Janis and Erin Aber-Givens. She's with the Children's Specialty Care Coalition. Dr. Janis is with Sutter. And Wendy Longwell is the mother of Derek Longwell, a 13-year-old with spina bifida who relies on California Children's Services. Thank you very much, all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, an update on the plan to try and bring the Winter Olympics to Reno and Tahoe, plus a program that helps homeless women back on their feet. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. April is Financial Literacy Month. On the next Insight, how should teenagers learn to manage their money and balance a budget? Also, the Sacramento Philharmonic presents Songs of Hope this weekend. You'll meet the featured Israeli and Palestinian musicians. Plus, The World Without Us, author Alan Weisman tells you about his best-selling book. Homeless women trying to reclaim their lives face many possible obstacles. In Sacramento, a program called Women's Empowerment helps them back off the streets and into housing and work. Some new graduates celebrate their success next week. Last year, I spoke with a previous graduate of Women's Empowerment. I started by asking Aniba Fuse how she became homeless.
I became homeless in 2004 after a layoff with AT&T. After about 5 years and 3 months.
Must have been a shocking event.
Yes, it was. It was very fearful.
Did you go straight from having a home to being homeless, or was it a gradual process into homelessness?
It was a gradual process into homelessness.
And what was it like when you actually were truly homeless and realized that that was your current situation?
It was very frightening, just not knowing the next step that I was going to take. It was very fearful.
What was the hardest thing about your life when you were homeless?
The hardest thing, and I wrote this in my biography, the hardest thing was having to be separated from my 15-year-old son because he was too old to go to the first shelter that I went to.
Because you could only have young children?
Exactly. He was 15.
How long were you actually homeless?
I would say for about a year or so.
Goodness. How did you figure out how you were going to get yourself back to a normal life?
Well, through friends and my mom. They told me about different programs. I first started off at St. John's. That was a shelter that I was not able to have my son be with me at. And then I was there for a while. And then after that, I was able to go to a shelter, Parker, that he was able to come and join me with. And then from there, of Volunteers of America, and from their Lutheran Social Services. And then through Women's Empowerment, I received so much information as well and referrals for housing. So
I could imagine, though, that there must be times when you're homeless when you feel despair about how you're ever going to get out of it.
Exactly. That is so true. And by being a part of Women's Empowerment and also being around the other women that were homeless, we're able to keep each other encouraged and just stay focused.
How did you feel the first time you went to Women's Empowerment? Because I guess when you're homeless and when you have very little money, it's hard to feel like you're really getting yourself as well presented as you might want to be.
Exactly. When I first went to Women's Empowerment, it was a new environment. I'd never been there before. But through all the beautiful staff, knowledgeable staff, and my other peers, were able to like I said, encourage each other, receive information for housing, job referrals, and all the other staff that was able to come and volunteer. We were able to receive all the helpful information that we needed.
It's Aniba Fuse. She graduated from Women's Empowerment in 2005. It's a Sacramento program that helps homeless women get back on their feet. Also with us, Lisa Culp, the Executive Director of Women's Empowerment. Lisa, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
What's the first thing that needs to be done when a woman comes off the streets and wants to, you know, live a more normal life?
I think one of the things that's so important is that homelessness is such a process of isolation, of feeling disenfranchised from the community and hopeless, as Aniba was saying. And by bringing women together who are experiencing a lot of the same things, they begin to know that they're not alone, not only because they have each other, because frequently when they first get there, they say, I don't like women, I don't want to be around women, I don't trust other women, but because they are together every day, even though they're homeless. It's a day program, and they may go back to the river. They may go back to the streets. They may go back to a shelter or a friend's house. They come together, and they begin to form a bond of trust. And volunteers from the community come in. And because people are willing to dedicate their time and share their skills, they begin to see that they really aren't alone or disenfranchised.
Aniba has been nodding a lot.
So true.
Yeah. What was it like when you first walked in?
When I first walked in, it was just a safe haven for women. For women, not for men, but a safe haven for women where we can, no matter what had gone on in our lives, where we can just come together, let our guards down, and just be there for one another.
What happens next, Lisa, once there's a certain amount of trust been established and a sense of community? When do you get going on, I guess, more mundane things like a wardrobe and resumes and stuff like that?
Well, we offer 8 weeks of classes, and the classes are all taught by volunteers from the community. And half the curriculum is really focused on your basic job-seeking skills. You know, how do you put together a resume? What do you need on a master application? How do you answer questions about a gap in your work history? So we really work on a lot of the practical skills. But I think the part that makes the program unique is what we call the personal empowerment curriculum. And volunteers from the community will come in, and they'll do storytelling. They'll do journal writing. They'll do creative art. We have a process where women begin to write their own biographies. You know, on the walls hang the biographies of women from history, and each morning they'll read those. And by the end of the 8 weeks, each woman has written her own biography. And she looks at where she is, but she also looks at where she wants to go and the inner strength that she's found and kind of the roadmap that she's going to use to get there. So during those 8 weeks, they have class. They meet with a case manager, but they also meet with a volunteer job mentor, who, again, is a woman from the community who meets with her once a week and just works with her on her career goals. And that volunteer job mentor is like the bridge from this situation of homelessness to the community that the women really long to be part of.
Aniba, tell us about the life story that you worked on for yourself. How did you change your view of yourself once you'd gone through this process?
Sure. Well, with the different programs that my son and I were able to stay at, having us have stability, housing, being able to take care of our hygiene, that allowed me to get back on track and stay focused to be able to start seeking employment. So from the housing, being stable with housing, I was able to seek employment. From Women's Empowerment, I received different temp jobs. And then from there, I received another part-time job with Big Brother, Big Sister, still seeking employment with Regional Transit. And that has just been awesome, truly a blessing from the Lord. And I have been with Regional Transit. It'll be a year in August as a full-time bus operator, just past my 6 months probation. So it really pays off to be persistent and stay focused.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How are you different today compared to the Aniba Fuse before you became homeless?
I'm different today because I've learned so much more. You cannot take life for granted. Things can happen just in a matter of seconds. Your life can change in a matter of seconds. But thank God for Women's Empowerment and the different housing programs that are out there to assist you to get back on your feet when life does happen.
And how is your son doing? How has he changed?
My son has changed. He wrote a essay that just blew my mind. It was just awesome. It was awesome regarding being homeless and how when he gets older and starts his career and employment, how he was going to give back to the community as well. And so that really made me know that he appreciates everything that we have gone through to make us better. So we do want to volunteer as much as, you know, we can.
How did losing your job and becoming homeless affect your relationship with your son?
Actually, I think it brought us a little bit closer. Yeah. It really did. Yeah. He knows that I have done all that I can as a single mom to raise him properly. And I've always kept the lines of communication open. I let him know the decision that I was going to have to make as far as giving up our place and we having to be separated. And it was hard, but we were able to, like I said, continue to stay together, keep the lines of communication open, and just continue to love and trust and lean and depend on one another.
Aniba Fuse, 2005 graduate of Women's Empowerment, and also Lisa Culp with us. Lisa, how many women would be in a class at one time?
There's usually about 25 women in each class.
Yeah. And how much time are they spending together?
Well, the class runs from 9 to 12 in the morning, and then there's optional parenting enrichment classes in the afternoon and domestic violence classes. About 89% of the women who come to Women's Empowerment have experienced domestic violence. It's actually the leading cause of homelessness for families.
Now, what's the success rate? Clearly, Aniba has done extremely well.
She sure has.
Is that the case with everyone?
Well, About 85% of the women who graduate get into stable housing, and that in and of itself is huge. And there's another 85% who either enroll in school or who become employed.
When you say stable housing, what does that mean? That means, well, what does it mean?
Well, it depends. If they come to Women's Empowerment on the river, the first place we try to get them is into shelter. But as Aniba was saying, it took her and her son 3 months to get into an emergency shelter where they could be together. So it's a long process. So, and you have to move through almost each step of it. So the first thing you try to do is to get into a temporary shelter and then hopefully a longer-term shelter. And then from there, you have enough time to get on waiting lists for subsidized housing or transitional housing programs or to earn enough money and save enough that you can actually get into market-rate housing.
Now, the 15% or so who don't go into stable housing eventually and the 15% or so who don't go into education or get a job, what happens to them? Where do they go? And why do they not make it to housing or education or work?
Some of them continue to be homeless. And we've had women who have come back after, usually if they graduate, we don't let them do the program again because they have too much fun in the program. We want them to take the next step. But if they have only made it through part of the program and then they drop out, they get a chance to come back because change happens when we're ready. And our case management staff is there continually for women, whether they graduate or they don't graduate, to help them access resources in the community. A lot of the women who come may or may not ever be able to work because of their physical health, their mental health. So we hook them up with resources that meet their needs currently, because the most important thing is to get women and children off the streets.
Well, thank you both very much for coming in today. That's Lisa Culp, Executive Director of Women's Empowerment, the Sacramento program that helps homeless women back on their feet, and Aniba Fuse, a very successful graduate from 2005. Aniba, Lisa, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
The next Women's Empowerment graduation ceremony happens May 1st. This is Insight. We're going to follow up now on a story we covered a few weeks ago, the plan to try and bring the Winter Olympics to Reno and Tahoe. A survey was commissioned to find out where the public stands, but a news conference to release the results was cancelled because of the sudden death of the man leading the Olympic effort. Last week, the survey results were finally released. Joining us again with details and a look at what might happen next is the Reno Gazette Journal reporter who's covering the issue, Ray Hagar. Welcome back to Insight.
Jeffrey, thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Well, the survey's out. How much interest is there among the good folks of the Reno and Tahoe area?
Well, according to the survey, 51% of the people polled by the Reno Tahoe Winter Games Coalition said they would support the area in hosting a future Winter Olympic Games, which they want to get here in the year 2018. Now, this, Jeffrey, this was not only a poll that was done in Nevada, but it was also done in Placer, El Dorado, and Nevada counties in California. And it also has the backing of one of your politicians there in California, Mr. Ted Gaines. He's a Republican assemblyman from
Roseville.
Yeah, he dresses like a Democrat, kind of talks like a Democrat, but he certainly has a Republican haircut.
And he was at this press conference.
Yes, and he also pledged his support to the Games Coalition. He said that something kind of un-Republican. He said that some people in California would be willing to raise taxes to support the Games, and that is the key issue, I think, here in Nevada, is that, you know, our state is full of Californians who didn't want to pay California taxes, so they move over to Nevada, and so state taxes is a major concern. But now, the lieutenant governor of Nevada, another Republican, Brian Krolicki, said it would cost about $1.5 billion to bring the Games here in 2018, and he felt that $1.1 billion of that could be forked over by the federal government. Mm-hmm. Other stuff could come through revenue bonds, domestic and international television rights, and ticket sales. So they really downplayed the need for state taxes to get this thing going. But they really need a lot of infrastructure improvements to get the Olympic Games here. For example, Interstate 80 on both sides of the state line would really need a lot of work done. And as you know, in around the Reno, Tahoe, and California areas, there are two seasons. There's the summer season and the construction season, so there would even be more construction there. And in Reno, our local football stadium at the University of Nevada would have to be vastly improved, 20,000 seats. We'd have to build an indoor ice arena. So there's a lot of hope by many people in the area that they could indeed land the Games, but there is a huge amount of work to be done.
$1.5 billion doesn't sound to me like an awful lot of money if you're talking about upgrading an interstate freeway that goes across a mountain range, build an arena, upgrade a football stadium, and who knows what else.
Yeah, you're right, Jeffrey. When they threw out the $1.5 billion size of this, I was kind of skeptical myself, because I could see this thing going easily, you know, $3 billion at least. But, you know, I don't think they wanted to scare everybody off right away. And I don't know what would be and not be included in that $1.5 billion. Perhaps they're not figuring in the need for the stadium improvements, nor the need for a ice arena. There's no place to play hockey here right now. There's no bobsled. There's no luge. Where are you going to put these things? And what about the environmental concerns to put this thing here? I know that, for a lack of a better word, a lot of people who like the environment, who many Nevada Republicans would call tree huggers, they don't want this kind of infrastructure built here.
You said that the survey found 51% support. That's a slender majority.
Did you
get the impression that the backers saw this as a setback?
No, the backers, you know, these are people that, you know, when you look at the glass half empty or half full, they are very positive, and they look at this as half full. Now, about 38%, or excuse me, 31%, said they would not support any of the efforts to host the Olympics, while 18% said they weren't sure. They didn't even know what you were talking about, or they were, you know, smoking the bong. We don't know. But there's 18% that are not sure. So 51 yes, 31 no, 18 who knows. So they take that as a pretty good shot. Now, some people have called in the credibility of the polling. It was done by Research 2000 of Washington, D.C., and the pollster himself, a Mr. Del Ali, I know very well, and he's a really good guy, but and he's done a lot of polls for the Reno Gazette Journal, and they've many of them have come to fruition. But where some people doubt him is that in the last election, the 2006 election, his poll that came out just a few days before the election picked that all six Republicans would win the constitutional offices in the state of Nevada, and bada bing, only two out of six won. So, you know, that's kind of like the New England Patriots going undefeated through the year and then losing the Super Bowl when you when you pick two, only get two out of six right. So,
and quickly, Ray, do we know what happens next?
Oh. You know, that's a good question, Jeffrey. I think what's next is that the Winter Games Coalition, which is now headed by fine gentleman John Killer, and he's the acting chief executive officer, they will continue with their grassroots effort to gain support for the Olympics. We're all waiting for the Olympic bids to be issued early next year. Now, what would really throw a wrench into this is if the city of Chicago is selected to host the Summer Olympic Games in a few years before these 2018 games, because if Chicago is selected to play host to those Summer Games, the International Olympic Committee is not going to award the same nation or, frankly, the same continent the Summer Games and the Winter Games back to back. But it's the feeling, smart money, this is a betting state in Nevada, smart money says that Rio de Janeiro and not Chicago will win those Summer Games, which would open up an avenue to bring the 2018 Winter Games. You know, this would really be a bi-state effort. I mean, Northern California, Sacramento would be as big a player in this as the Reno Tahoe area, but the Olympic Committee has to designate one city as the host city. So, you know, Reno was selected as the host city simply because I think we're closer to all the mountain areas than you are in Sacramento. But Sacramento would be a, you know, a 50-50 partner in this thing, and would, you know, it would benefit your economy as much as ours, because, and look at...
Ray, we'll have to wrap it up there. I'm afraid we've got some other guests here eagerly waiting outside our studio. I have a hunch we'll be returning to this topic. Ray, thank you so much for the update.
Sure, Jeffrey, anytime.
Thank you. That's Ray Hagar, reporter at the Reno Gazette Journal. He's also co-host of Nevada Newsmakers, a political show on Reno's KRNV-TV. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the Sacramento Saturday Club. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of the oldest music societies in the western U.S. holds a concert this weekend at Sac State. The Sacramento Saturday Club was founded in 1893 to promote culture in the city. As well as putting on concerts, the Saturday Club gives out scholarships. Two of the musicians playing at this weekend's concert are former scholarship recipients. One of them joins us, along with a decidedly long-tenured member of the Sacramento Saturday Club. We'll start there with the group's president, John Koza. John, welcome.
Thank you for having us on today.
Well, there aren't many organizations in Sacramento that date back to 1893. What's the Saturday Club's secret?
Well, we started out as a club to promote musical interests, and we brought some very famous artists to Sacramento before there was the symphony and the opera and the ballet, including people like violinist Fritz Kreisler, singer Luisa Tetrazzini, many other famous artists. Now we have private musical concerts, but our main focus is supporting young musicians with the scholarships that we give out every year.
Also with us, Margaret Heilbronn, longtime member of the Saturday Club. You joined, Margaret. Welcome.
Yes.
You joined when you were 17, and that was 1932.
Right.
Okay. You can tell people are doing some calculations. Why did you join the Saturday Club back then?
Well, they invited me to do the audition, and my accompanist was Lawrence Hahn, and this was an all-ladies club. So he played for me for the audition, and these little ladies just thought he was pretty much. So they decided to change from all women to having men members.
So it was an all-woman group at that time. Why was that? Do you know?
Don't ask me. They started before I was born.
And tell us about your own musical background. What instrument were you playing?
I play violin and viola mainly. And I was concertmaster of the Sacramento Symphony, the Philharmonic, for 15 years. And I had played in this symphony since I was senior in high school. And
give us a memory, a favorite memory of yours of the Saturday Club, the Sacramento Saturday Club. Because as John Koza explained, at that time it was a very, very important group in terms of bringing big artists, orchestras, musicians to town.
Yes, my mother paid $10 for a ticket to the Memorial Auditorium to hear Spalding play. And I was 12 years old at this time, so I was mostly impressed by the beautiful flashing diamond on his bow hand.
How many concerts were they putting on at that time? Do you know? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. They had a whole series of concerts. And I remember the Boston Symphony came and the New York Philharmonic, and there were ballet programs, and Heifetz. I heard Heifetz, and I heard Fritz Kreisler.
Goodness. Well, John, as you mentioned earlier, the Saturday Club was founded when there was no Mondavi Center and other organizations bringing classical music to town. Well, there is quite a lot of classical music nowadays brought to town. How has the role evolved of the Saturday Club?
Well, we've changed our focus to we are a private musical club that puts on monthly house concert performances, but we feel our most important aim is to support young musicians. We give five $1,000 scholarships to Sacramento State University every year. And every other year, we hold a competition for young musicians aged 17 to 26 from Sacramento and adjoining counties.
And a former scholarship winner joins us. He's Tim Stanley. Tim, welcome.
Thanks.
You're a cellist.
Yes.
Now, when did you win your scholarship from the Sacramento Saturday Club?
I won it 2 years ago. Okay. When I was finishing up my master's degree there.
And what did you do with the money?
The money went to mostly cover a little bit of cost of living and materials and things like that for the cello. It's quite difficult to try and keep any kind of day job when you not only are you a student, but you're a music student and have 4 to 6 hours of practice requirements per day that you have to do. So it pretty much paid rent while, yes, I was living here and working on my master's.
You're a member of the group that's playing at the Saturday Club concert this weekend.
Yes.
Tell us about your group.
This group is a Baroque quartet. We play flute, violin, cello, and harpsichord. And we were all students of faculty members at Sac State, with the exception of our flute player. But we were all trained in the Baroque idiom by Dr. Lorna Peters and Dr. John Dornenberg, and they sort of got us really excited and geeked out about Baroque music, and we decided when we were done with school we were going to keep playing that kind of stuff. So.
And your group is called?
Ensemble Confluentes, okay, which is a Latin word that means where two rivers meet.
We have a clip of Ensemble Confluentes that we're going to listen to, and this is from a piece by Telemann, and this is, yeah, going to be in the concert on Saturday.
I don't know if this particular Telemann quartet will be on there, but
well, I've been told that it was.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, then yes. Okay, I'm not sure what you're going to play, but yeah.
Let's listen to it. Said that you and your fellow musicians got geeked out about yeah. Baroque. What is it you like about Baroque?
You know, it's a little bit how challenging the music is. It's really it predates the Mozart, Haydn sort of common practice era where a lot of rules got fermented and sealed in. So people were still sort of inventing rules for how to play with chamber music and how to play just put notes together and so you have to sort of discover what they were trying to make happen, and it's tricky music. That piece by Telemann is one of the more sort of easy to understand pieces because he was a superstar and he was sort of writing the way people liked. But then you get thrown something by less popular composers of the day like Bach or a Couperin or something, and it's all curveballs. And so it's challenging and really fun.
Because Telemann was more popular in his day than Bach was.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Margaret, they sound pretty good, don't they?
They sound wonderful.
John, how would you describe the state of classical music in Sacramento today?
Well, I think we moved here 5 years ago, and I think things are really burgeoning since then. There are so many concerts to see, so much opportunity for culture, but I hope that people will find a place for the Saturday Club. We have our own website that one can check out, SaturdayClubOnline.org. And we offer for the music lover private home concerts of club, and you can be a performing member. Many of the members are Sac State faculty. So we had some very high-quality concerts in our last season.
Home concerts, literally in someone's home.
Yes, they are mostly in homes. We sponsor a Crocker concert every year at the Crocker Art Gallery. In February, we have a concert of the scholarship winners from Sac State. And on May 17th, we're going to have a concert of the winners of our competition we just had on Sunday, the Steve Vermont Memorial Competition.
Mm. Margaret, are you still actively involved in the Saturday Club?
Well, I haven't been going very much. I can't go out at night very much. And after all, next month I'll be 93. So.
Well, congratulations. Do you still pick up the violin?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Have you ever brought it out? When was the last time you played for the Saturday Club?
Oh, many years ago.
Many years ago.
I haven't played for them for a long time.
Yes. And John, we should note, you're a pianist.
Yes, I'm pianist, accompanist, teacher. I staff a company at Sac State for strings and trumpet and voice, and I teach at UOP and American River and do a lot of freelance accompanying and teaching in the area.
And Tim, you're very early in your career. Do you hope you'll be able to stay in Sacramento and practice your profession?
Absolutely. I actually just got to the point where I could leave my little part-time job and start making music full-time, teaching and playing. And it was an exciting day for me when I could devote 100% of my energies to it. And, you know, there's people around that are really, really supportive all the time. And a lot of people at Sac State and the Saturday Club are part and parcel of that.
And the other members of Ensemble Confluentes, do they all live in Sacramento too?
Yes, the area? Yes.
Yeah. Very good. Well, we've been talking about the Sacramento Saturday Club, the city's oldest musical organization, founded in 1893. The club is promoting a concert this weekend at Sacramento State on Sunday afternoon at Capistrano Hall with Ensemble Confluentes. One of the members is our guest, Tim Stanley, who's a former scholarship winner from the Sacramento Saturday Club. Also with us, Margaret Heilbronn, a longtime member of the club, and John Koza, who's currently president and a music professor at Sacramento State. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us
today. Thank you.
And by the way, there's a scholarship winners concert on May 17th, John, too.
Yes, that is in the choral room at Sac State at 7 p.m., and it will feature Ariana Uri's soprano, Yunyao Peng piano, and Elaine Fitzgibbon cello, our three winners.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callis. And for more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producer was Andrew Frischman. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our interim producer is Robin Souza. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We're going out with a little more music from Ensemble Confluentes. Thank you for joining us.